Listening to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. And yes, we are all family, whether we have immediate family with us or whether it is the family of our friends and our communities. If you're a regular listener to Health Center, you know that I frequently talk about issues related to end-of-life wishes and care. I recall the days as a nurse when someone who was dying would be put in a hospital room at the end of the hall with the door closed. The patient would get, you know, necessary care, but the real message was that we shouldn't really look at or discuss dying. In fact, we often let family members decide not to tell a loved one that he or she was terminally ill. As a result, I witnessed horrible, lonely deaths. But we can and are changing this. Palliative care is a specialty that focuses on symptom management, and people are urged to declare someone as their healthcare proxy to make decisions if the person is unable to make decisions for themselves. So what happens as you're getting older? Maybe you're in a long-term care facility such as a nursing home. Well, Dr. Joan Carpenter is an expert in geriatric palliative care. She's an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, a health scientist at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and a nurse practitioner with Coastal Hospice and Palliative Care. Her research focuses on the implementation and evaluation of non-pharmacologic palliative care interventions for people living with serious illness and their partners. Joan, welcome to Health Center in the Catskills.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And tell us how you got into this work.
So this work, I think, has been a part of my nursing career since my first staff nursing position at the bedside. I worked in a specialty medical unit taking care of people with very complex illnesses, advanced cancer, HIV, AIDS. From there, moved on to working into neurology, where many people are living with serious illness that's not curable. And from there, I started my work in nursing homes, caring for people living with serious illness. In nursing homes, long-term care facilities. And I realized there was a lack of information, skills, knowledge among many of the staff who were working in that setting. And the difference that I was able to make as a primary care provider really was quite rewarding. And it made me think about how I might be able to make a difference locally as a clinician, but to really broadly affect how we can improve caring for people living with serious illness in nursing homes, I needed to pursue a doctorate and create a research program to expand those high-quality evidence-based services to everybody who is living with serious illness.
And I want to just acknowledge, for transparency purposes, as well as to acknowledge Joan's achievement here, that Joan, you are a Betty Moore Nurse Innovator and Leader Scholar in a program at the University of California at Davis that has been funded by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. It's quite a remarkable program. I do teach in that program as well, and it's how I got to know Joan. I mean, Joan, you really stood out in that group as somebody who had deep expertise in this area and really cared about older people, people in nursing homes, and what their experience was in these last days of their lives, these last months or years of their lives. So you've talked about the importance of having high-quality conversations with people living with serious illness and their families. But what constitutes a high-quality conversation?
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because I think this is a topic that many of us as healthcare clinicians and providers were not taught in our educational programs, in our training. And high-quality conversations are ones that we use communication skills that are empathetic, that respond to emotion, that allow patients and their families to explore different treatment options and ask questions that we answer honestly. Many times in healthcare, we tell patients and families what they should do. Mm. And really, what we should be doing is listening to what's most important to our patients and their families and providing information along those lines. So the previous approach to having conversations was to wait until there was a health crisis and to ask questions such as, do you want us to do everything for you? And what do we think about when someone asks us, do you want us to do everything for you? Well, of course I want my clinicians to do everything for me. And so what we need to be thinking about is changing our approach to having conversations earlier in the course of illness and talking to patients and their families about what they hope for with their medical care. What is it what is it that they would like to achieve with the different treatments that are being offered to them, and how does that help them reach their goals for their medical care?
So are we dancing around the idea that these conversations also should involve their preferences about if they know they're terminally ill and are dying and what they might want?
Absolutely, if that is a topic that a patient and the family is ready to talk about. One of the concepts in serious illness conversations, we talk about high-quality serious illness conversations, is to ask a patient and family what they understand, and then how much do they want to know? Are they ready to continue having the conversation, to move at the pace that the patient and the family are ready to do so? I can't tell you, though, how many times I've been able to talk with a patient and family, and once we have had this conversation and we talk about what they understand and what they want to know, they say, nobody's ever told me that. Mm. They say, I've been sick for 2 years and nobody's had this conversation with me in this way.
Wow.
And so, right, as you mentioned, Diana, it's dancing around this idea, but I think these are such emotionally driven conversations, and emotions can be uncomfortable for clinicians and families and patients alike.
So
we talk about responding to emotion and expecting emotion.
Say more about that. Give me an example.
So many times a patient or family may be quiet, and we may take that as a clinician, a patient or family may be quiet, they may not be interactive. We may take that as that they aren't interested in having the conversation, mm-hmm. when really they may be very scared. Mm-hmm. During a conversation, a patient or family may start talking really quickly. They might show signs of being upset or angry. And instead of responding to them in the same way, it's giving that person time and asking them about how they're feeling, what are they most concerned about, and how we can help them.
Great. So then at what point do you have the conversation about, do you have a healthcare proxy, and do they understand what your wishes are at the end of life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so important to be thinking about who you would want to make a decision if you weren't able to do so. And as we know, we can't foresee all of the different situations that may happen when we may no longer have decision-making ability. And so many people think having an advance directive is all that they need to do, you know, have that written document that says what they want in certain situations. That's important. But what is really important is have the person that can speak for you and be having these conversations with that person about what your goals are, what's most important to you. That's something I think about a lot when I talk with patients and with family members who may be surrogates or friends who may be surrogate decision makers. Tell me about the patient. Tell me about your dad, your brother. What kind of person are they? What did they enjoy doing? And as we get into those conversations, and I can understand that they know that the patient in a way that other people don't, Then we start to talk about, you know, what their goals were, what would make them happy, what they think that person would want in the situation. So thinking about a person who can make those decisions for you based on what you believe is most important. They know you well.
And do you have any advice for people, whether it's the person who has a serious illness or the family member, for how to initiate a conversation about, you know, can we talk about the goals for that you may have, or your end of life wishes? How does one initiate that conversation?
Well, I think it's a great topic to be thinking about, because what we'd really like to see is that patients and their families are doing this with primary care providers who they're seeing every day or frequently. In a nursing facility, it may be a primary care provider stopping in every day to see the resident. But in, you know, out in clinics and, you know, community settings, maybe visiting once a month or every other week for people with ongoing complex illnesses. But being able to go to your primary care provider and say, I want to talk more about my illness. I want to know more information. I want to know what the next month, what the next 2 months, what the next 6 months are going to look like for me.
And what about the family and the patient, but it's the person with the serious illness, having the conversations among themselves without the healthcare provider? I raise this because I had family visiting over the holidays, and it was extended family member who probably in his late 40s. And he brought his daughter, who was around 20. And offline, I asked him, or apart from her, I asked him, have you had conversations with her about your end-of-life wishes? His wife and he drive every day to their jobs, and it's an hour away. And they've realized that, you know, if they're in an accident, she could lose both parents in very suddenly. And so he said, and was thinking about that. And I think people have a hard time with initiating these conversations.
These are tough conversations, especially, you know, for people who are maybe in their 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, not expecting something to happen that could, you know, change their life dramatically in that way. I do think that being able to have an open discussion with a trusted person in your close family and friend circle about what it is that you would want if something would happen and you were unable to make decisions for yourself, and knowing that they would respect that. So opening up the dialogue with, I've been thinking about this, you know, especially around the holidays, we talk about that because we're seeing friends and family. But, you know, anytime that something like this might come up, and saying, I want to have an open conversation with you. I want you to know that if something would happen to me where I was unable to make my own decisions and you were you were the person responsible, I want you to know these are my wishes. These are my goals for my care. And that takes the burden off of the person making the decision, for example, your family member, friend, the 20-year-old, knowing that person is then acting on previously stated wishes of the parent, as opposed to feeling all of the burden of the decision. Because, you know, many of us know what we want for our close family and friends, in that we don't want we don't want to have to say goodbye to them. We don't want to have to, you know, make those decisions. And so having that pre-work done where you know what they would want and you're acting on what was said can be helpful.
You know, I've talked before in this program about the fact that my husband and I had many conversations about our end-of-life wishes and preferences. He had, 2 years ago, he had a massive stroke. And once I saw that that the healthcare system was putting him on a train that he did not want on. He had watched his mother and his grandmother both linger after strokes and being disabled, unable to communicate, et cetera. And he did not want that. And we had many conversations about that. So I felt very comfortable. I mean, it really helped me to know what I needed to do in that situation. And I try to share with people that it actually helps the person who has to make these decisions. These are very hard decisions. But when the moment comes and you know what that person who you love, what that person's wishes were, what decision they would make for themselves, it becomes almost a gift that you're giving them. That's the way I felt with my husband. It was the gift that I gave him to move him to comfort care as fast as possible. However, once he got into what they called comfort care, you know, we had the palliative care team come in and then they sent the hospice person in. I still had to fight with the, and particularly the nursing staff, to not intervene more than was necessary and to do for him what he needed to be comfortable. Why is this so hard?
So there's multiple, I think there's multiple reasons of why it's hard. One of the first concepts that comes to me, though, is the fact that we do not require education around palliative and end-of-life care in basic training programs for nurses and healthcare providers. Mm-hmm. And with that, you know, one thing that we know as a nurse is that it is highly likely that we are going to be at the bedside or we're going to be caring for a patient and their family at the end of life. Mm-hmm. But yet we don't prepare our clinicians to do that. And I think part of it is because of the way the hospital system is. Another reason is the way the hospital system runs. It's an acute care environment. It is created for short-term stays for people to stabilize or achieve a better level of health and be discharged. It's not always meant to be a place where people come to spend the end of their life, and it's not always comfortable for people, for clinicians. So, there's, you know, as I said, there's a couple things. Clinicians are not always prepared, and we're seeing changes in that now. We're seeing more programs implement end-of-life education and palliative care education in the basic training program, mm-hmm. and provide opportunities for people to learn about ways to implement palliative care within their daily practice as a nurse, as a clinician. Mm-hmm. And then we are also seeing more of a culture change in hospital settings where when we, you know, realize that somebody is seriously ill and approaching end-of-life, that we can have a palliative care team come in and help to advocate for the patient and the family. It's a slow change, as you know. Things yeah. change so slowly in healthcare sometimes, the cultures. But it is happening.
So let's talk a little bit more in detail about this issue as it applies to people who are in particularly long-term care facilities, nursing homes, after they've been hospitalized. What do these settings need to do?
One of the challenges is that nursing homes, post-acute long-term care facilities also, you know, this kind of fall in the same bucket, is they're created as environments that provide both, you know, residential care, social care, but also medical care. So people, you know, arrive to a nursing home for post-acute care after hospitalization and are oftentimes receiving continuing therapies that they were receiving during hospitalization with the goal to attain their previous level of function. The challenge lies in people who are seriously ill and are not going to achieve a previous level of function and quite honestly may decline rapidly as maybe the different treatments that were being given during hospitalization, like an antibiotic or maybe more what we call potentially burdensome treatments for people living with serious illness. These treatments, while they may have been stabilizing a patient medically, they may not have actually been contributing to a patient getting better the underlying illness. So the illness continues, the chronic condition or the terminal illness continues to worsen, but we may have been able to kind of handle the acute illness. But once the treatment for the acute illness ends and the acute illness resolves, the the terminal illness continues to decline. And that can be a really challenging time for a patient and a family because they were expecting to arrive at this facility for a short period of time to achieve a previous level of function, quote unquote, get better. And so the environment doesn't always support that decline because the idea is to get better. And we haven't always had frank conversations and really open conversations about reassessing levels of function, reassessing how a patient is doing during those first few weeks after hospitalization. And as you mentioned before, it's like this train. It's this, I kind of compare it to a treadmill too. It's just you're put on this action, these different actions, these different interventions that are supposed to be, you know, just moving along and moving forward, but yet the patient's condition is declining. And so it can be really hard to accept that the condition may not get better when you have everyone around you who is trying to say that, oh, we're gonna try one more thing. And that doesn't always work. Instead of having conversations of, we're in a different place now. Mm. 2 weeks ago, we were here. Now we're at a place where, you know, we've done a few things. We're not seeing the condition get better. And that is a really, really tough time. And that's where, again, communication skills come in and being able to talk openly about changes in condition and about progression of illness and about what's next for a patient and their family.
And so what recommendations do you have for both patients and families with serious illness in this vein? What other recommendations? It seems to me that, as you've just been talking about, facilities have their routines, that they have their cultures and how they approach certain things. And it can be often difficult to deviate from those. So let's say you've got a parent in a nursing home and their condition, as you described, is not getting better. They're over the acute episode, but the underlying condition, they continue to deteriorate, but nobody's having the conversation about what's going to happen here. Do you encourage family members to talk with the patient, to talk with staff? I know there's a lot of discussion around talking to people about what are your goals right now? What are the goals that you have for your life right now? What's most important to you? Is it longevity? Is it quality of life? Is it being with your family? What are your goals? But even initiating that can be challenging, can't it?
It's very challenging. One of the things, just in my personal and professional life, that I advise families to do in the nursing home setting is to request a care plan meeting, to request a family meeting that involves, especially in post-acute care after hospitalization, that involves the therapy team, that involves the unit manager, that involves the primary care provider, that involves the anybody else who might have, the speech therapist, if someone's receiving different interventions for swallow function or speech. To bring all of those people together in the same place and ask questions about where are we now, where were we, where are we now, and where do you see, my family member or friend, where do you see healthcare, where do you see things going in the next couple of weeks? And to say, how are we going to move forward in a way that meets the patient's goals, it meets their treatment preferences. And again, having that conversation with the patient, what are your treatment preferences? What do you want? Where are the trade-offs too? Some patients will say, I want to live until I see my grandson graduate. Okay, what are the things that we can do to keep you, toward that goal, but also, meet your goal of being comfortable. Where are the places that you can make change in the care plan to do that?
And Joan, do most nursing homes have access to palliative care specialists?
Unfortunately, they do not.
I didn't think so.
Nursing homes typically do not have access to specialty palliative care. Those teams have been centered in hospitals and in hospital-based clinics primarily. We're seeing a growth of palliative care in nursing homes, and some of that is really coming through clinicians being what we call trained or gaining knowledge and skills in what we call primary palliative care, because we know we don't have the workforce for the specialists to meet the need of all of the seriously ill residents in nursing homes. And one of the things I think is really important is that if you do have a family member, if you are in a nursing facility, to ask if they have access to palliative care. Do they have a specialist, or do they have, you know, specially trained staff who maybe have an extra set of extra skill set in palliative care? They may not be a specialist, they may not be certified, but they have extra skills, and they can help to guide some of these conversations and the care plans.
Well, and we are about out of time, but if people want more information about your work, how can they access it?
Well, I would be happy for them to visit the University of Maryland School of Nursing website, where I have a webpage. I also have the Carpenter Collab website, which is my research team's listing of the different work we are doing, all the different projects, the different settings that we're in, as well as the publications of work that we've done. And I'm also on LinkedIn, and I'm also on Twitter. I'm so happy to connect with any of the audience in those venues.
And her name is Dr. Joan Carpenter, a registered nurse and expert in geriatric palliative care and associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, a health scientist at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, and a nurse practitioner with Coastal Hospice and Palliative Care. You clearly don't have enough to do, Joan. I want to thank you so much for coming on to Health Center and the Catskills, and I want you to promise to come back as the studies unfold and you have findings that you'd like to share with our listeners. Thank you so much, Joan.
Thank you so much, Diana. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
Bye.